EUC.
To you out there, and thank you once again for being here with us, and for you coming here for the first time, welcome to our podcast, The Enabling Space, Voices of Civil Society Resilience, an EUC podcast which aims at throwing light on the threats to and opportunities for enabling environment around the world. I am Clarice, and as always, I am super happy to be with you all once again. Our guest today is Catharina Vieira, a Dutch politician of the Progressive Green Left Party and a member of the European Parliament. Hello, Catharina, and thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Clarice. Very nice to meet you, and thanks for the invite.
Oh, thank you so much. We feel honored. But before we begin, just in case some people are out there who've never heard about you, do you mind beginning with a brief introduction of yourself?
Of course. So my name is Catharina Vieira. I'm a member of the European Parliament for the Dutch party GroenLinks PvdA. In the European Parliament, I'm part of the Greens group. I'm 29. I was born and raised in Portugal and moved to the Netherlands in my early 20s. Before coming to the Parliament, I used to work in civil society and some Dutch NGOs in environmental and human rights issues. And then I went on the list and ran for the Parliament. And that's my life now.
Oh, wow. In such a short time, you're able to achieve so much, and especially for your age and everything, super inspiring for the young people listening out there. Thank you so much once again for being here. And let's dive into today's topic. Around the world, we have seen a surge of youth-led protests from Nepal to Madagascar. And as a young person and also as a member of parliament, what do you think distinguishes Gen Z activism from earlier movements that had been recorded?
So maybe to give a bit further context, since I joined the parliament, I have been coordinating the Greens work on the subcommittee on human rights. So I'm exposed to a lot of the human rights developments of the past few years. And obviously, the Gen Z protests have been a big episode in all of that. I think it's a really interesting phenomenon because they are linked and they're also disconnected. So they can at the same time find a lot of global solidarity, a lot of linking points, the fact that it's often raised by younger generations, young people, the fact that these are protests often on the streets that are organized online, the fact that they use the same platforms, Discord, TikTok, Telegram, Signal, that things go viral. Like in many ways, they resemble each other. Sometimes on the themes as well, I feel like opportunities and equality of opportunities for young people in a given country is a recurring theme, or fighting against corruption is a current theme. But sometimes, you know, each country has its own flavor and each country has its own problem. So it is definitely a new phenomenon, and it's linked in many ways. And at the same time, it can be quite hard to find the golden thread that unites them all, other than they are indeed happening at a rapid pace in very different parts of the world. And I feel like they are motivating each other and generating this wave of support across different countries.
Especially made possible with social media, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge component. People get on the streets, but they hear about it online.
And then it pushes others in other parts of the world. I can do this too. And we end up with a wave of protests like we are seeing. And in contexts such as Nepal, where civic freedoms are currently under strain, how are young activists even managing to organize and mobilize despite restrictions? And how do you think information put on spaces such as the EUC website is helpful in understanding what is happening around the world?
So I think whether you're speaking about Gen Z protests or wider human rights demonstrations, labor rights demonstrations, whatever it is, we do see a shrinking civic space as a trend in so many countries. So the fact that people are out there and protesting in many situations, it's to be applauded, just the fact that they are there. And often people are not there without a huge risk to themselves, to their well-being, to their careers, to their families, sometimes to their lives. So I think just the fact that we see young people mobilizing and fighting for their future is really inspiring. And it comes often, unfortunately, at a very high cost. And I do believe it's made possible as well by internet, and that raises a lot of questions of, you know, how safe and secure are you online, and how much can you voice a differing opinion, or how much can governments also take over, for example, with media shutdowns, social media shutdowns, electricity shutdowns, to kind of, we've seen that in many countries. And I do think there is then the more organized civil society, whether it is on the countries where this is happening or globally, they are there as an opportunity to bring all of these movements together, to bring evidence-based, inform advocacy campaigns, or just reports, to report on what's happening in a way that we can see the correlations, that we can see where are things happening, how are they linked to each other, why do they matter on the context, because often we don't have the context of what goes on. So I think both this kind of looser structure of activism combined with more old school, so to speak, or more organized civil society come together to make sure that people are informed and are able to participate or reflect on these protests.
And if you're out there wondering where you can get up-to-date information on what is happening with the enabling environment around the world, get more information on these Gen Z protests, make sure that you stay tuned to the EUC platform as well as consortium partner member platforms. I'm talking of HIVOS, Transparency International, Civicus Forums as well, the European Partnership on Democracy, and you'll be sure to get all the updates in real time. And Katharina, you mentioned the internet, and I'm just going to englobe them as the digital sphere. You mentioned it a bit, but what role do you think that digital tools are playing in all these movements, and how are governments responding in ways that either enable or suppress this new wave of activism?
I really believe that the kind of mobilization that we see in many of these cases wouldn't be possible without the internet, and governments have become aware of that as well. So I think people are being very intelligent on how to use different platforms, how to, for example, share quick updates, mobilize on very last minute. I've seen it also when I visited Georgia, for example, which has been more than a year of protests. People are able to react to an incoming information and to organize very rapidly. And that's only possible because of social media. Also, for example, if we see traditional media has a role in reporting this for the country and globally, but social media also plays its own role, because lots of young people in other countries hear about what's going on in Nepal or in Madagascar or in Bangladesh through social media. So it also amplifies the message to others. But obviously, governments have caught wind of this, especially those who already were quite autocratic, but sometimes even democracies do not hesitate to introduce bans or shut down the, as I was saying, electricity, or shut down certain platforms for a couple of hours, a couple of days, a couple of weeks. And that's obviously problematic, as is the use of mass surveillance. Again, this is an example I saw quite a bit in Georgia, the use of cameras to track protests and use AI to identify who the protesters are and be able to find them. Also, the governments are able to find out and use technology for their own advantages, especially if they want to repress those who are on the streets. So while technology enables these protests, it also really hinders them at the same time.
And at times, what has been observed is when the governments actually try to use these restrictive methods, it inflames the young people even more, you know, it gives them even more desire to be out there protesting. And as a community, a civil society, as a world, what lessons can we learn from how Gen Z is reclaiming public space and reshaping political conversations, both online and offline?
Well, I think it's incredibly inspiring. I think that's the first thing that we need to see. For example, I've spoken a couple of times with activists from the Philippines. What happens there is that if you are an activist and you go against the government, you really risk it all. You risk being the subject of campaigns of disinformation about yourself or about your family, like shaming you online or offline. You risk being put into jail. You risk just disappearing. And people disappear for months and for years, and no one can track them down, because it wasn't the official police, it was some militia or it was some paid security force. So I guess what the message this brings to us is that it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of courage to be an engaged citizen, and it comes at a price for everyone. And some people are paying really, really high prices for their willingness to fight for their beliefs. And I guess for us who, you know, even in more democratic, and even in democratic countries, we can see the consequences. Some people have consequences on their personal life or on their work life for their activism. And to me, what this brings is this need to be inspired and realize that it is worth it. Fighting for the things you believe on is worth it. And of course, you should take into account your safety. But I think what this brings is a big wave of solidarity and inspiration for when we see things wrong, even if it sometimes comes at a cost, we need to be part of the solution and part of changing what we believe is wrong.
You're absolutely right. And there is also the case of Myanmar, a crisis that continues to receive way too little global attention. How would you describe the current state of the enabling environment over there, according to your own recent research?
So with Myanmar, as you said, I have this particular interest. I'm quite saddened to realize that so many people don't know what's going on there. So I had the opportunity to travel to Bangladesh with a human rights subcommittee, and there we visited the largest refugee camp in the world with more than 1 million Rohingya refugees. And the Rohingya are a minority from Myanmar who has been repressed, taken away their citizenship, treated with immense violence, and essentially pushed out of the country into Bangladesh, where they've been for 8 years on a temporary status. But this temporary status seems to last on and on and on. And it's not the end of the story, because all across Myanmar, since the military junta took over, it's not just the Rohingyas who are targets. There are dozens of local minorities, religious minorities, and even the general population is under so much threat. Bombing of civilians is known, is expected, is commonplace, is a way that the military uses to repress those who are trying to rise against this. And they are getting organized and they are trying to fight back. And this turned into a full-scale civil war. And obviously anyone, trade unionists, people who worked with civil society, people with connections to civil society in Europe, those people are particularly targeted. There are accounts of up to 30,000 political prisoners and lots of people who've had to just flee the country. So it's really problematic situation. We don't hear about it. And we now expect that later this month, in December, the junta plans to hold an election. So they plan to ask people to come out and vote when they are being repressed, arrested. There are huge internet blackouts, there's bombing, but they think this is a condition to hold an election and give legitimacy to the government, which is completely unthinkable. And perhaps just to top it off with a sad story that keeps on getting sadder, it seems to work, because the US administration has just said that Myanmar is making improvements in democracy and it would be safe for people who have sought refuge in the US to be sent back to Myanmar, which is absolutely not the case. So really, we see a lot of the ingredients of what's wrong with repression and what's wrong with civic space come together in Myanmar in a very painful way.
Katharina, you've worked on urgency resolutions for political prisoners across countries. How can national, regional, and international actors meaningfully support civil society and activists in countries with restricting spaces like the ones you were just mentioning?
Yeah, I've been very involved in many urgency resolutions here at the European Parliament, which I think are a good example of one of the tools that is important for all of us, civil society, but also governments at all levels to do, which is to denounce what's happening. Because oftentimes, honestly, there's so much wrong in the world that it's hard for people to keep up with everything that goes on. So first of all, the basic that can be done is to share information if possible. And often that information will put pressure on authorities who are, you know, causing the repression. So specifically from the European Parliament, we raise awareness to the issue and we also ask member states to address this in their diplomatic relationships with the countries. We often also use the resolutions as a starting point to then do our own engagement with embassies or with governments. We just, you know, agenda setting is the first thing, and pressuring the governments that we think can be made to change their policies. And this also means, you know, using the tools and the leverage that we have, in my case, in the European Union. So, for example, trade agreements, negotiations, or the maintenance of trade agreements should be subject to the compliance with human rights rules. And this should be very clearly spelled out in the agreements that we have, in the partnerships we have with countries, trade or otherwise. And it should be enforced. So if a country is conducting severe human rights abuses, that should be a reason to use our leverage. Further from that, there's lots that can be done and that should be done. We should continue to fund civil society, particularly in the countries where it's most under pressure, and find ways to decouple the money that goes to civil society from the money that goes to the government. And that can be very tricky, and I'm aware of that. But we should continue to support civil society, because otherwise, you know, who else can they turn to? Not only financially, but also in capacity building, if that's needed. And finally, particularly here in Europe, as European countries, we must also come to terms with the fact that there are people who are facing enormous danger, and they cannot be in their countries anymore. And therefore, we need to also have legal pathways for asylum, for those who are human rights defenders, good visa protocols. And, you know, of course, we can't be expected to help everyone, but we need to take part in making sure that there is a safe place, either temporarily or permanently, where human rights defenders and environmental defenders can come to through formal structures and through civil society programs. It's super important that we also open our doors and provide a safe harbor for those who are escaping violence.
The right to a safe space, the right to seek asylum is a human right, and everyone should indeed be paying attention to it and trying to cater for those as well. And you've responded to the question I was about to ask. So I'm just going to maybe ask this final one before we let you go. How do we bridge the gap between local movements and global policymaking to ensure that the people most affected by repression are heard? And do you think spaces such as the EUC, led by civil society organizations, could maybe be the way?
That's a great question. And I have to say, as a person who is new to the European Parliament, I don't know how I could ever do my job without civil society. And that is why I am so worried about the multiple attempts to reduce funding, both as the European Union, but also as member states, to international development and cooperation, and funding to NGOs. I think whether we're talking about civil society in the countries, in our partner countries, or we're speaking of European civil society, it cannot be stressed enough that they are incredible sources of information, and not just information, because you need information to take action. And I completely rely on the reports and on the lobbying, because essentially this is lobbying, and we have to understand other interests, like economic interests, will have their lobbying, and we need independent research and civil society research, academic research as well, that also needs to have a place in policymaking, that also needs to have a place for lobbying. And I could never do my job, both the human rights work and also the trade work, without having strong civil society organizations by my side to help me get informed and figure out the way forward. So absolutely, I see civil society as a huge part of how to do good policymaking, and therefore how to make the world better for all of us.
Thank you so much, Katharina, for taking out time to speak with us today. Before we let you go, do you have any final message for our audience out there?
If you are an audience of this podcast, then you're really doing more than half of the work. You're engaged, you're interested, and that is already super inspiring. So I guess the message to them is the message that I sometimes have to remind myself of as well. Even when times are tough and everything seems really complicated, there are always ways in which we can affect change and try to get things to be even a little bit better. So try not to get discouraged by the huge problems of the world, and focus on the two or three or four things that you can do, and that will make a positive impact on all of us. And if all of us were to do that, then we would surely have a huge impact.
Wow. Thank you so much, Katharina. It was such a great honor and a great pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you, Gladys. It was my pleasure.
And to you out there, we say thank you as well for your time, for being with us until now. Our guest today was Caterina Vieira, a member of the European Parliament, and we spoke about the rise of Gen Z movements across the world and the role of international bodies and solidarity in supporting an enabling environment for civil society. Stay tuned to all EUC platforms for more information on the Gen Z protests and much more. And until next time, take care of yourselves and of each other.
EUC.